In education, and this relates to the test, in education we are always dealing with one of two choices, you know, in this testing area. In the one case, we can hold instructional time constant. That is what I suspect about 98% of higher education is. That is, everybody takes the same course for 16 weeks or for 9 weeks or 10 weeks or whatever it is. Inevitably, if I hold instructional time constant, I'm going to get variability in achievement, just as surely as you're sitting here. Inevitably, too, if I hold instructional time constant, the testing approach that I use then is very likely to be one in which I am trying to determine some kind of rank ordering of students. Now, we like to tell ourselves very often, you know, that this is not what we're doing, that we have certain set standards, etc., but it just doesn't work that way. The other alternative that we have is presumably to hold achievement constant. That is, I say in instruction, you will continue to work in this area until you have reached this level of competence. When you have reached that level of competence, then you test out, as it were. Now, if I hold achievement constant, then inevitably I will get differences in what? Time, huh? I'm going to have to deal with one of those two in a curriculum. If my program is scheduled in such a way that everybody pretty much takes courses in the same time frame, then I'm going to have to deal with differences in achievement, and that drives the person who takes the next course crazy. If, on the other hand, I hold achievement constant and I say no one can get out of this course until they reach that level of achievement, then it drives who crazy? The registrar. Is the registrar here? Okay. Why does it drive the registrar crazy? Because everybody's in all different courses. You know, one student takes 3 weeks to finish a course, and another student takes 6 months to finish a course. Well, it ought not to surprise anybody then that 98% of higher education, you know, runs in terms of equal time interval because it's more convenient. We all know who runs institutions: the registrar's office. The two most powerful people on any campus are the registrar and the person who assigns the classrooms, at least on any campus I've ever seen. The people who really run higher education are the people who sweep the floors. You and I as faculty, I guess, ought never to forget that. But if I am dealing with this kind of instruction where I allow flexibility in how much time students can study, and then I have a competency test of some sort, then very often I can use that test to tell a student, look, what you have done is you must achieve 75% on this. You have achieved 65%. Now this is what you're going to have to study some more to get that extra 10%. But by and large, in higher education, that's not what we're doing. We're not dealing with that kind of measurement. So that by and large, the test as a post-instructional activity is done pretty much for purposes of assigning grades and for purposes of giving us some general idea, at least, about how effectively we've taught. Now, that brings us directly to the third part of that thing. We've talked about goals, we've talked about instruction, now I want to talk about evaluation a little bit. If you remember, I made the point early this morning that we are always in education making best guesses. That is, I establish a set of goals, whether I do it as an individual or whether a faculty committee does it. I establish a set of goals and those become something I hope to attain. I choose methodologies, and on the basis of the goals I've set and on the basis of the students that I'm going to teach, I say, it looks to me like probably the best way of doing this is that if I develop a summary and if I try to use small groups and if I do this kind of testing at the end, that's probably the best way to pull this course together. But that's always an estimate. It's always a guess. Now the question is, how do I determine whether I made a good choice? How do I determine where do I need to revise? How do I determine whether or not my goals were reasonable? Maybe I've just plain set unreasonable goals. Maybe I've just made bad choices of methodology. Who knows? But at any rate, I've got to have that evaluation information. Now, how am I going to do that? And again, I think just to put another general statement in here, it seems to me that this is the other of the two aspects of that model that I talked about this morning that is most commonly forgotten. Because it's very, very difficult. It's very time-consuming. And the payoff tends to be long-range rather than immediate. Well, what can I use? Primarily, the source of information that I have for this evaluation are the students themselves. Now, I can get this information two kinds, rather typically. First of all, I can ask the students for their perception of the experience. Again, I don't do you use student evaluations? There's been a lot of discussion, and there's a voluminous literature on the use of student evaluations. Just a couple of comments about that if you want to use that as a basis. The first comment is, I don't think you ever use it as the sole basis for revising a course. For a couple of reasons. One, that if the evaluations you give the same results my evaluations get, I don't know how I'd do it. Because what tends to happen is if I try to make a course relatively informal, half the class is the greatest course I ever had. I wish we had more classes like this. And the other half of the class says what? Geez, I wish you'd just give it to us, you know, lay it out for us. I'd do it this other way. So then the next semester, I did when I was back a few years when I was starting. So the next semester, what I would do is I would, you know, tighten up the course and make it more formal with much less direction from up here. And now what happens? I still get a 50-50 split, except that I get a different half of the class saying it's the best course I've ever had. But there's some important things that you can get from student evaluation. But there are some things to remember when you set it up. First of all, it seems to me that you ought to, on student evaluations, only deal with those kinds of things which students are competent to judge. And I think one of the mistakes that frequently get made in student evaluation is that we ask students to evaluate things that they're simply not competent to judge. One of the very frequent questions that gets asked on student evaluations is something like the faculty member's mastery of the content. Bad question. Terrible question. Why? The student is not competent to make that judgment. Who's the group competent to make that judgment? Peers. Huh? That is not a student judgment to be made. Now, was the nature of the course made clear? That students are competent to judge. Huh? Were the presentations clear? That a student is competent to judge. Were the tests fair? That a student is competent to judge. But there are a number of things very often that creep in that students are not competent to judge. So that's first criterion. Secondly, I think we ought only to ask student comments in those areas where we are both willing and able to change. You know, I have seen questions put on student questionnaires that have involved issues that the individual faculty members simply had no effect on. Such as, do you think the grading system was appropriate when the grading system was established by the institution? Now, I suppose if a number of faculty do that and they tend to get the same kind of feedback, then that can give you some information you can use. But there are certain kinds of things that over which individual faculty members simply have no control. A third issue that arises here, or a third area that I think is important when we start talking about the use of student questionnaires, is the whole matter of when and how that questionnaire is administered and how those results are used. It's interesting. I'm always finding myself at odds with the people in central administration on our campus. Some of the people in central administration on our campus, because it seems to me there is a strong feeling on the part of some people in the area of accountability that somehow or other student evaluations of teaching should be made an integral part of the institutional evaluation of the faculty member. I'm opposed to that for a couple of reasons. But the major one being simply there are ways in which you can manipulate those student ratings. And the other is simply that many of them simply are inappropriate. It seems to me the primary usefulness of student evaluations of teaching should be for the faculty member involved, and faculty members should be assured that their evaluations would be held confidential. Provided they're taken seriously. Except in those cases, if you're talking about probationary faculty, beginning faculty, there are other ways in which they can be used. But in terms of the manipulation of these things, then the faculty are just likely to be more honest about how they deal with these things under those conditions, and they're likely to be more useful all around. If I'm really interested in making my faculty ratings look good, what I would do would be something like this. I have no idea what your institutional policy here is. But what I would do would be I would carry those student questionnaires around with me until I had had what I had judged to be a couple of really good days in the classroom. Now, there are good days and there are bad days. And student evaluations of teaching are subject to kind of what happened with the recency phenomenon. You have a couple of really good days in a classroom in a row, that's the day you give the student evaluation. Huh? For sure, you don't give it the day after a test. Never. You don't give it the day of the test. Never. They're influenced, and the other thing, I think, insofar as certain kinds of methodology is concerned, and certain of the things that the students put on on the questionnaires, is that students sometimes just don't know what's good for them. And they might evaluate a faculty member very negatively for doing something that, in fact, was good for them. Now, the burden is on the faculty member to indicate very clearly why that is that way. But I think the use of student questionnaires in terms of evaluation is important, but it seems to me the primary value should be to the faculty member involved. That's really where the emphasis should be in the use. And the information that we request on those evaluations should be the kind that is likely to be most useful to the faculty member in making revisions in those courses. Another source of frequent information about effectiveness of instruction from students is just the test results that we get. And here I'd like to talk a little bit about testing, just very, very briefly, about 5 minutes maybe. In terms of how we go about pulling these things together and how we remember here as in all the other areas, what is the best test depends on what it is we're trying to measure. I just gave my question away. That was a dumb thing to do, Lowell. How many of you prefer multiple choice questions to essay questions? How many of you prefer essay questions to multiple choice questions? Now, I would ask you to indicate why, but I won't. I just wanted some expression of difference of opinion, and I wanted to see who was awake. Which is best? Well, it depends. It depends on what you're trying to measure, what you're trying to get at. Multiple choice questions have some very, very significant advantages over essay tests, whether appropriate. They're much, much easier to score reliably. You can sample much more broadly with multiple choice tests than you can with an essay test. They're much more difficult to fake. They're much less time consuming to score. They tend to make more efficient use of faculty and student time. In terms of student time, it takes a long time to write an essay item. I don't know how many of you remember your last essay test you took, but I have a sneaking suspicion that in an essay test, what typically happens is that it takes this in a typical 1 hour exam. It takes the student spends about one fourth of that time, probably no more than that, thinking of the answer they're going to write down and spends the other three-fourths of the time doing what? Writing it. Just the mechanical aspect is tremendously time-consuming. Now, there are certain kinds of outcomes that you simply can't measure very well with a multiple-choice test. If what you're trying to deal with is the ability of the student to synthesize ideas, for instance, that becomes extremely difficult to do with a multiple-choice test. But you can do it. You're always balancing in making testing decisions. You're always balancing one thing off against another. I think one of the test items that was at one time frequently maligned, but I guess one that I'm kind of... I really do like true false items. It takes a lot of time to build, but you can ask an awful lot of questions in a class period, true false questions, if they're carefully written. You can get a lot of information about what students know from a really well-constructed true-false site. And that's basically why you give tests, isn't it? You give tests in order to give you some estimate of what students have learned, of how they've changed. And what you want is you want that estimate to be just as valid and just as reliable as you can make it. And what you tend to get in terms of reliability, you do tend to get better reliability with a multiple choice or a true-false item. You know, you can ask 150 true-false items in a one-hour test where it's an appropriate item type to use. You can ask, what, maybe a couple essay tests. That's about the limit of it. If you're dealing with a course, what you're talking about here is you are trying to achieve one or two very general goals. And these goals involve the ability of the student to synthesize ideas. Then an essay test is obviously appropriate. What happens if you're teaching a class where you cover a lot of different topics and you deal with a lot of different concepts and a lot of different ideas, and you want to determine the degree to which students can recall and deal with those ideas? What happens if you use an essay test to do that? Very limited sample, huh? So that suppose there are 5,000 things that you hope the student picked up from that course, and now you're going to use an essay test to evaluate that course, and you can ask three questions. You can sample those 5,000 with three questions. You can dip into it. Now, you don't have to have had much statistics to know that the reliability of any estimate you derive from a sample depends very, very heavily on what? The size of the sample. So if I can dip into those things that the student knows, and I can dip in at 150 places, I'm going to get a better estimate of that overall level of achievement than I can if I can only dip in at once or twice. The other is the whole question of validity as it relates to testing. And I think one of the statements that I hear once in a while that really raises the hackles and raises red flags in my idea is when someone comes away from a test and says, I really foxed those students that time. They didn't have any idea that's what I was going to put on that final test. Huh? Bad test. Now, that's as blatant as I can be. Anytime students take a test and come away saying, gee, I didn't know that test was going to have that stuff on it, one of two things has happened. Either you ought to revise your instruction or you ought to revise your test. Why? In terms of what I've said up to this point. Well, no content validity, and then what you've got presumably is that test is supposed to give you some estimate of the degree to which students have learned what you've been trying to teach them, and what you've been trying to teach them is what you told them you were going to teach them at the beginning of the course. Huh? So if the whole thing was a mystery to them, kind of until the end, then either the students weren't informed and they weren't kept informed during the course about what was important or what wasn't important and what was expected of them or what wasn't expected of them, or they were told that, but then the test measured something else. Now, let me end it. That has, when students talk about tricky questions or a tricky test, that very often is what they're talking about. What they're saying essentially is that, look, what that test covered is not the kinds of things that we were led to think were important. But what you want to do, use that test for, is to determine the degree to which the students have learned that which you thought was important. So that by the time you have provided the students with the pre-instructional things that I've talked about, by the time you have prepared the instruction and throughout that emphasized the things that are important, students should really have a very good idea of what that final test is going to look like. How many of you think students ought to study for the first test? Ought to study to do well on a final test? Absolutely. If the test is valid, that's what you ought to be doing. That's another comment you sometimes hear. You know, it's bad when students study just for the test. I could care less if students study just for a test, so long as what is true. So long as that test is testing what I think is important in this course, then there should be absolutely no inconsistency between learning what's important and studying for the test. They should be one and the same. And if I've developed my instruction adequately and if I've built my test adequately, there shouldn't be any problem at all. In fact, one of the advantages of the pretest, you're not talking about using a pretest sort of as a pre-instructional device, one of the advantages that has is that, first of all, it reduces some of the anxiety associated with that test, but secondly, it gives students a pretty clear idea of just exactly what it is you think is important, the kinds of things you think are important. Now, that doesn't mean you have to use exactly the same items, but they should be items that dip into the same kind of pool of outcomes. So the whole notion of testing as being a game we play with students is an inappropriate one. The whole notion of a test is something that we sort of throw at the end of the course. Geez, we have to do it. You know, we have to write this thing. Everybody has to give a test, and everybody has to take a test. It's just inappropriate within the framework I'm talking about here, because that testing becomes an integral part of the whole instructional process. Now, the last thing I want to talk a little bit about is grading. How we use grades, how grades fit into all this. It seems to me that grades are essentially symbols that we use to provide people with information about a student's level of achievement. Now, it might be the student, it might be the student's parents, it might be a future employer, it might be a congregation, who knows? But that's essentially what it's all about. So when we decide what grading system we're going to employ, it ought to be based on considerations about the degree to which a given system provides good information, useful information. A question was raised with Dr. Taylor's discussion about letter grades and numerical grades, those sorts of things. Does it make any difference? Doesn't make any difference at all. I read these long discussions about the relative merits of letter grades and number grades, and the merits of those. Now, the ABCD, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 versus pass-fail, that does have some implications, because when you're talking about a pass-fail system, you're talking essentially about providing, unless you have very clearly identified what it means to pass, you're not giving people very good information, very complete information. A few years ago, there was a big movement to move to pass-fail grading. I see that pretty much fading. I see more and more emphasis going to a 5 or a 6 or a 7 or an 8 level grading system. But where appropriate, it can certainly have the effect of reducing some of the problems and some of the anxieties involved with grading. One of the major problems that I see with that is that what tends to happen is that students work only to that level required to get the passing grade. I jibe some of my friends who are very fond of this kind of thing. They keep talking about mastery learning. It's a mastery learning phenomenon, his theological education. If students achieve at a certain level that has been established and identified and described, then they're said to have reached mastery level, and then they pass. You know, above that, you pass, and below that, you got to work some more. I don't think that's mastery. I think it's misnamed. I think that's minimum competency. Because in most of the things that most of us teach, no one ever achieves mastery. What we're doing essentially is establishing the least you have to know in order to pass out of this thing. Now, and that's appropriate in some areas. I guess I could think of areas in virtually any program where that kind of minimum competency would be appropriate. But I think we ought to be aware of what we're doing when we build those things in. It's interesting, too, that in terms of the traditions, the way in which we sort of get tuned into viewing grades in certain ways and sort of moving back to old familiar ways. I think one of the most interesting experiences I had in this regard was about 4 or 5 years ago. I was working with our College of Dentistry on their grading system. They had letter grades, and then they decided that they got caught up in the mastery movement, and they decided that since they admitted a very select group of students, and they tended to pass all the students they admitted, that letter grades were very difficult to make the differentiations they had to make. So what they were going to do was go to a pass-fail system. They also went to a very flexible curriculum, so that a student would stay in a given course long enough to meet this minimum competency, and then they would pass, and then they would go on to the next one. Well, it becomes a nightmare to try to administer, to keep track of where everybody is in all these programs. But apart from that, the faculty committee, I was working with this faculty committee, and they came up with this suggestion, and I tried to caution them, throw a caution here and there, but they were really going to do this. So they started out, the first semester they did it, they went pass-fail. Then, a semester later, they said, well, yeah, pass-fail is okay, but there's some of these students that are passing that are really superior, and that superiority ought to be recognized. So what we need, really, is a fail, a pass, and a pass plus. Huh? Well, that went on for a semester or two, and then somebody said, yeah, that's true, but, some of these students that are failing, some of them are really off the bottom, and others are just under that minimum competency. And what we ought to do is recognize those students who are almost there to kind of encourage them. So what we need I don't remember what the terminology was anymore. What we need is pass plus, pass, and fail minus, I guess. That's not the terminology to use, but that would have amounted to it. So what they started out was with a system that went A, B, C, D. And now what did we have? Pass plus, pass, fail, fail minus, huh? A, B, C, D, we had a 4-point scale. Just by way of thinking, how we tend to slide back into those things, and we tend to slide back into this 4 or 5 scale thing, and we tend to get back to symbols that we're familiar with. I don't know, what grading system do you use here? A, B, C, D. Just by way of a technical thing, you might be interested to know that there's general agreement around that in terms of reliability of grading, reliability of placement, at least if you're dealing with norm reference testing, that you can probably go up to about a 9-point scale in terms of your grading procedure, in terms of information provided. And you can probably deal with that reasonably well with a 9-point scale. So you could probably go 5-4 above the 5 that you use. If you get above that, it becomes a real nightmare to deal with by way of assigning grades. You go below that and you lose a lot of information. But again, using this scale in combination with some kind of pass-fail system in certain kinds of basic courses is what a number of institutions have done, and it's found it useful enough for their purposes. Okay, it's now 3:15. I guess we have, a few minutes? 15 or 20 minutes? Comments? Violent disagreements? Suggestions? Yes?
You mentioned both true false choice. It seems to me when I find that kind of what's required for it, many true false or again false choice.
Well, I guess I would use the word valid, and here we're talking about are they questions that do in fact measure what it is we're trying to measure? Too often, I think true false items become simply going into a textbook and pulling out 150 statements and inserting not in half of them. That is not a good true false test. Those are not good true false items. The same thing can happen with multiple choice items. I think multiple choice items have gotten the reputation of being the kinds of items that can measure only direct recall. How many facts the student can learn. That's just not true if they're carefully written. I think one of the things that we have to recognize is that good test items take a lot of time to build. And that's particularly true with good multiple choice and good true-false items. You don't write 60 good multiple choice items the evening before a test. If you can write 4 or 5 good multiple choice items in an hour, you're probably moving along pretty well. Now you can write a few more true-false items than that in an hour. But one of the things you have going, rather typically, the true-false items become particularly useful if you have large numbers of students and you can use them over and over and over again. The other kinds of student supply questions might be more useful if it's a very small group of students and you won't use the same test over and over again. So there are a batch of very specific kinds of rules and regulations relative to writing good multiple choice items and good true false items.
What is your suggestion to administer the question that you said not before or after the lesson?
Well, on a kind of an average day, I guess what I would be inclined to do would be to find a day that wasn't a particularly bad one or a particularly good one and use it then. Obviously, it has to be far enough into the course so the students have some idea, had a chance to know what you're doing and how you do things. Very often what happens is we administer student evaluation forms at the end of the semester. Well, by that time, it's too late. By the time you're 3 or 4 weeks into a course, students have a pretty good idea of how you do things in a classroom. Administering it at that point provides you an opportunity to maybe redo some things during the course of that course. Otherwise, you're going to have to wait until the next time you do it. I guess what I would be inclined to do, I think that's probably about right. If you pick a really bad day or a really good day, then you don't know exactly what you're going to get. Now, you'll have some students who will give you pretty direct answers without too much influence in that sort of thing, regardless of when you give it. I do think it would be inappropriate to give it at the time you give a test. But as soon in a semester as the students have had a chance to make some evaluations of how you're teaching, and on a kind of an ordinary day. The other thing you do, I don't know how it is here, but on our campus, Friday classes, there tend not to be very many, students, maybe a third of the students aren't there on Friday, especially the Friday before a big football game. And the students that tend to be there are the students who really like the course. So if you happen to have a really good lecture day on Friday, when the students who like the course are there, man, you can just blow the top right out of those evaluation forms. In other words, hey, Dick? Okay. Yeah, I do. The paper indicates that I'm a member of our Redeemer. We've transferred to Prince of Peace in Coralville, which is a mission congregation. And let me talk a little bit about the conversations I've had with the young man who serves as the pastor, who is an excellent, excellent man. He's not a graduate of this seminary, but he's an excellent man anyhow. There are some good ones that come out of that place up north. We're sort of the old folks in the congregation. It's a very young congregation. I think our ratio of baptisms to funerals last year was about 10 to 1 in favor of baptisms. And my wife and I are sort of among the old folks in the congregation. So when he first started working out there, he, you know, we spent some time talking with him, and he spent some time out at our place. And he was asking questions, wondering what was, he'd been in the ministry 2 or 3 years before he came there. And I, number one, I said, you know, I'll overlook a lot of mistakes you make by way of administration. I'll overlook a lot of mistakes that you make by way of forgetting an appointment now and then. But there are a couple of things I expect, that I really expect of the man who's my pastor. One is that I want him to be theologically alive. I want him to be sound, but I want him to be constantly learning. The thing that Dr. Tickle was talking about, I want him to continue his studies. Because when I come away from a Bible study that he conducts, or if I come away from a sermon, if I can't say, I didn't know that, when I come away from that, I feel cheated. I've sat through sermons where you really get turned on during the sermon, and after it's over, you could plop, all disappears. I've sat through other sermons where I was attentive, but I didn't get all turned on by the sermon, but I went away and I could sort of feed on that for weeks, what went on in that. So I guess in terms of the training that you do, the educating that you do, first and foremost, it seems to me that you need to train people to be teachers. And you need to provide them a model to be teachers, because it seems to me a sermon is, to me at least, in a very significant degree, teaching. I want that person to be effective in presenting the gospel to other people, and that's teaching. Now, the really beautiful part of that is that it's teaching where I don't have to assume all the responsibility for the change which occurs. It's teaching where I present the gospel as effectively as I can present it, and then I can say, hey, God, now it's up to you. But I think we ought not to make the work of the Holy Spirit unnecessarily difficult. And I think sometimes we do. So I expect that. And I guess basically that I want that person to be firmly grounded in the Scriptures, and I want that person to be able to present that gospel, that message to people in an effective way. Now I hope there are some other things that person can do. And I hope that person sees that teaching to involve not only the sermon on Sunday morning, but counseling sessions that they have with individuals, that involves confirmation instruction. That's a whole different story. That's a real wilderness as far as I'm concerned. But that's essentially it. I guess in terms of the changes that I'd like to see seminaries make in the people that come here, they're not all that complicated. They involve a lot of things when you get down to how do I develop a lecture. But the goals aren't really really all that competent and that broad. I think one of the mistakes that we have probably made is that we have tried to teach too many things specifically in all the programs, whether it's in theological training or other training. We tend to think we have to teach everybody everything, and we do not identify the essential. So what happens then is we spend a lot of time teaching some things that people could learn on their own, or that they could be screened for having had before they come into the program. I don't know, does that answer your question, Dave? Now, I expect if you talk to another layman, you might get a very different answer. But, you know, the people that I talk to and the people that I know, I think that's really what they're looking for. Now, there were a couple of other hands that I didn't... Yeah?
You did mention something about the multiple choice test, the true false test. It seems to me that beginning teachers, especially older ones too, have to be reminded that to create a valid test of that type is an extremely sophisticated task. And unless one has worked a little bit in tests and measures, he doesn't even know the pitfall. So how to divide this valid multiple choice about giving it away.
I think that's true. But the same thing could be true of any testing device. The same thing is true of an essay test. You see, but the advantage The insidious thing about an essay test is that its shortcomings are not as obvious as those of the multiple choice and true false test, because to a very significant degree the shortcomings of the essay test are more subtle, they're more insidious. Partially because many of those shortcomings lie in the scoring. It's easier to write a good essay item than it is to write a good multiple choice item. Now, there are some pitfalls in writing essay items, but it's generally, it takes less time and is easier to write a good essay item than it does to write a good multiple choice item. But the scoring of essay items is just, a few years ago I was working with some of the people in our rhetoric program. We were working for the National Council of Teachers of English on English composition. And what we did was a complete literature review of all the research that had been done in English composition, whether it was methodology or scoring or whatever. And of course there the question was, how do you have all these papers that students submit and et cetera. All we did really was verify what people in testing had been saying for a long time, and that is that the reliability of scoring of an essay test is extremely low. But students very often don't know that. They look at the item and they say, boy, that item, that seems to have face validity. It looks okay. It looks like a good question. But they don't know what happened when that thing got scored. So they get their grade back, and then that's sort of the way it is. So students are more likely to complain about a bad multiple choice or a bad true-false item because the mistakes are right there. Yes?
The other thing I was going to say with respect to education at this particular level, if we are training pastors, training men to become theologians, synthesis is a major goal. And therefore, at this level of education, I would expect predominantly the essay kind of examination if we are concerned about that goal. So I think there ought to be a balance there.
Yeah. Well, that's why I was mentioning that as one. However, we also in our evaluation will tend to measure different levels in the same test. That is, I am likely in a given course to have a set of goals that would read something like this. I want the students to be able to identify these people, to be able to define these terms, to see relationships between this term and that term. Those are our goals too, and then another goal would be to synthesize all this, which would suggest that what is quite probably appropriate would be some testing approach that involves some combination of items, so that we measure one set of outcomes to be achieved with that set of items, kind of item which is likely to be most efficient in measuring that outcome, and measure the other outcomes that can't be measured with that using the less efficient method, perhaps, but the more valid method, because we're talking about synthesis. Yeah?
I suppose I'm fighting here, but we work with people who have come from colleges, or college graduates, and so frequently it seems to me that they have learned only to work with the objective examination, because this is what they have been fed from K to college, and they haven't learned how to put things together.
Yeah, and to the extent that those represent the goals that we have, then an essay item is important. Yeah. Yeah, and there's some other things that go with testing. Well, you know, the nature of the test, how you're going to use the information, whether you're talking about a master test or this, these are all technical problems that we just don't have time to get into here. But they become very, very important factors. And I, on campus, have to spend the day after I give a test, always spend the day after I give a test, talking to people about testing. I don't care what the course is, because I think they have a right to know some things. It becomes such a complicated area in some ways. There are so many technical problems that can arise, but it's so important. We we base students' grades on them, and those grades are life and death matters for students. And yet I think very often we base those grades on information that is maybe not all that valid and maybe not all that reliable, that might be highly subjective. And then I think certainly that subjectivity is more likely to enter in on an essay test. So I don't know. I guess I hadn't thought of the degree to which that might be related to grade inflation. I suspect the other part of that relates simply to everybody wanting to be everybody's friend. The idea being that a faculty member was somehow or other not being the student's friend if the faculty member gave the student a C or a D. I guess there are students to whom I have given C's and D's where I was convinced that was the friendliest thing I could do. Because if I hadn't, someone else was going to, along the way, was going to tell them in some other manner that it things just weren't coming together for them. Yes. Yeah. Yeah, in fact, that's just good testing procedure if you're using essay tests. You ought always, after you have written an essay question, to write a model answer. That'll do two things for you. Number one, that model answer will give you a standard against which you can judge the answer students give. And number two, it'll give you some idea whether the question is answerable or not. I don't know if you have, but I have occasionally written essay items and given it to students, and then I get back a set of answers that are really bad. Geez, I've got to use an essay item to do this. And I get those questions and answers back, and they're really bad. And then I sit down and I try to write an answer. But then I can understand why the student answers were so bad, because it was an unanswerable question. It looked like such a good question. That happens all the time in comprehensive, by the way. Particularly PhD comprehensive. PhD comprehensives really become kind of verbal projective devices that we use. And I think in many cases essay items can be that. You know, in some cases, I suppose with an essay item, it doesn't make any difference what question you ask. The student tells you all he knows anyhow. So you just got to put something down there. They'll find a way, or they'll spend the first half a paragraph rearranging the question so that it answers. It's a question that they knew the answer to, not the questions you had asked. And some students are very skillful at this. They're very facile at answering around questions. And other students aren't. And those sorts of things, of course, get in the way of effective evaluation if you're going to use an essay test to do it. So these are certainly, but the point you've made about having that model answer is an absolutely essential condition for essay testing. Yes?
Right.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah. There are other ways that you can also have students put down any four numbers they want to put down, and then you pass around a sheet, and all they put on the what they hand in are those four numbers. Then on a sheet you pass around, they put down those four numbers and their name, and you put that sheet away and don't even look at that until you've scored the test. Except that what happens if the test is small enough, if the course is small enough so you can use an essay test anyhow. By the time you've gotten through the first test, you know the handwriting, particularly of the good students and the bad ones. You sort of don't remember the handwriting of those in the middle, but the very best, the very top and the very bottom, you tend to remember. So that even that doesn't do it, but you can. There are ways of ensuring that kind of anonymity, which become important. Well, I think I've... Yeah, Ron?
I just wanted to put on that grading of objective tests by listing the points that we think ought to be in an answer. I don't think that that's a universally valid principle.
Because there aren't any.
Essay questions are the most interesting types that measure critical thinking have no set answers, I should think.
But then you identify the characteristics of the answer.
Okay.
But it wouldn't have to be the exact answer they must give, but what you do is, in your model, you identify a good answer has these characteristics. And then when you give it back to the student again, you could indicate this was a good answer, except that this is the kind of thing I was looking at. I would also suggest that if you use an approach like that in essay testing, students ought in fact to be informed that's what you're looking for. That is, these are the kinds of things, you know, that I want, because that becomes then a part of the objective, if that becomes a part of the evaluation procedure that was used.
Isn't there even a definitional problem as to what you mean by an essay test? And for example, if you're asking a question that goes something like this, describe the 6 major factors that caused the Civil War. You know, there's obviously 6 points that you're looking for. But if the question is worded, compare the causes of the Civil War with those that led to World War II, or something like that, it seems to me you have a different kind of thing going on. The answer for the second is not quite so typical.
And what you'd end up with really would be that they would be both classified as essay items, but they're obviously measuring different kinds of outcomes. And then the problem that you have with the list type is that if you talk about verbalism and students learning just what's expected, I can remember a course I had years and years and years ago where the faculty was very fond of these listing questions. So what everybody in the class did is whenever a list of any sort appeared in any of your readings, you put it on index cards. And you memorize that, and then just before you stood out in the hallway waiting for the door to open to take the test, and then you'd go through those cards very quickly. And then you'd run in and grab the test and grab the pencil and look down through it to find the list question and get all those lists down so you wouldn't forget it before the end of the class period, which is a commentary, I guess, on meaningful learning. You weren't even going to retain it long enough to get through the end of the test period.
Yeah.
Fill in the blank. Yeah. There's a lot of blanks. Fill in with 6 long blanks in it. Yeah. Well, I guess I'd like to thank all of you for your attention. I've enjoyed it. I hope you've learned a thing or two at least. I know I have. And I wish you God's blessings on this coming school year, and all of the Lord's blessings as you begin considering the new degree, because you're going to need all of that you can get, I'm sure.
Well, thank you, Lowell, for thank you for taking time from your schedule. I know you have many, many irons in the fire and many things to do, and it's a positive way for us to think through a number of things as we get ready for the new school year. I see Hunt back there, and I assume that's going to be ready for us as soon as we conclude today's activity. There are not